The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week we're looking at the growth of the human species. We're joined by Bill Ryerson, president of the Population Media Center, to discuss some predictions for our global population and what kinds of effects we might see on the environment, our food and water supplies, and other minor inconveniences. But first, let's find out how those predictions are actually made and what kinds of errors might make them less reliable than we might hope. I'm talking to Ronald Lee, professor of demography and Jordan Family Professor of Economics at the University of California at Berkeley, where he's also the director of the Center for the Economics and Demography of Aging. Thanks for being here, Ron.
It's a pleasure.
Now, when I hear the word demographics, I think about the media, actually, and sort of carving up audiences for, say, a radio show. But that's not what we're talking about here. What does a demographer actually study?
Well, the term demographics does have a connotation of more applied demography, business applications, figuring out markets and things like that. But that's not what academic demographers are mostly doing. We're trying to understand, I would say, the causes and consequences of population change. So causes of population change have to do with fertility and mortality and migration, health, and such things. And the consequences range from environmental impacts, population and economic development, the economic costs and benefits of immigration, the consequences of population aging and the long-run sustainability of our social welfare programs, particularly for the elderly, and projections, sort of attempting to look into the future and make reasoned guesses or estimates of what the future population might be. That's another thing that demographers do.
Well, you obviously can't just go out and count people by hand like in some fields. So what sorts of research tools do you use?
There is a very long history of attempts to count the population different purposes. And in the past, it was for military purposes or tax purposes or religious purposes. And those kinds of enumerations go back probably 4,000 or 5,000 years. More recently, of course, we have the modern census, which is done periodically, usually every 10 years or so, which is an attempt to count everybody in a country or in an area in a fairly narrow time range. So that's the census, which is sort of the bedrock of demographic estimation. But that is complemented by vital registration systems where we, you know, you have a baby, you get a birth certificate, that birth certificate is recorded, the information about it is sent perhaps to a province or a state, and from there to the central government, and then from that, we build up information about the number of births and how old the mothers are and perhaps what race, ethnicity, education, these kinds of things. And then we can use those in relation to the information from the population census to calculate birth rates and death rates by age and by other characteristics of the population. Now, many poor countries don't have very good censuses and may not have very good vital registration systems either, and then we have to do other things. But for a country like Canada or the United States, more developed countries and some poorer countries that just happen to have very good data systems, we have the kinds of data I just described.
So you mentioned some ways that those projections could be unreliable due to not having accurate census data. What are some of the other ways?
Yeah, so the first thing is you could be wrong in the census, which gives you a starting population, of course. And if you're going to project forward, you do it from what you believe to be the case today. If you've got that wrong, then you've got errors in the future population. But larger errors than that are introduced by being wrong about the vital rates, about being wrong, particularly about fertility, but also about mortality. So you might miss a lot of births, for example, or it might be that most deaths lead to burials, but those aren't reported in the vital statistics system. Or it might be that you have a population with many immigrants, and when they get a terminal illness and are going to die, they may leave the country, go to their home country, and die there. And then they will lead to an exaggerated estimate of the death rate in the home country and an understatement, an underestimate of the probability of death for someone living in the receiver country, like Canada, for example. So if you underestimate the death rate, then you will be projecting too many people from those alive today will be alive in 10 years or 50 years or 80 years. So that's one important kind of error. Another important kind of error comes on the fertility side. So some of these are measurement errors, similar to the mortality errors I described. There may be births that are missed, that aren't reported. It may be that the age of the mother giving birth is misstated. And these kinds of things lead to errors in the reported number of births. Or in a third world country, where the vital registration systems may be completely unreliable, we have other kinds of surveys. There's a huge survey effort called the Demographic and Health Surveys. These are done in many third world countries around the world. So those use relatively small samples, perhaps 5 or 10,000 people that supposedly will be nationally, been carefully selected to be nationally representative. But trying then to estimate fertility based on these survey responses can lead to various errors as well. Okay, so that's a second kind of data error. If you get that wrong, then you're going to get the rate of population growth wrong, and the rate of growth of population sort of compounds. So if you have it too low, your errors are going to get bigger and bigger and bigger in the same direction the further you go into the future. Another kind of error, which I think is more serious, doesn't come from errors in the base data, but comes in your assumptions and understanding about what's likely to happen in the future. How are things likely to change? And because we're talking, for example, when we talk about future fertility or marriage, divorce or migration, we're talking about human behavior. And human behavior is difficult to predict, even in the aggregate. So the industrial countries of the world, the rich countries, have an average fertility today of about 1.5 or 1.6 births per woman. If you think of how many births a woman is expected to have over her reproductive years, that's roughly speaking what this 1.5 or 1.6 measures. Now, that's below replacement. For the population to remain constant in the long run, it requires about 2.1 births per woman, because she has to replace herself and she has to replace her mate, her husband, or partner. So 1.5 or 1.6 is a low fertility rate that will lead eventually to population decline at, say, more than 1% per year. Is that going to continue in the future in the rich countries? Well, we don't really know. We have thousands of scholarly papers. We have lots of theories. We have attempts to project fertility, but we could be completely mistaken. And if we're completely mistaken and say we predict that fertility will continue to be low, as it is in Canada today and in most of Europe and in some of East Asia, Japan, then we could just be wildly wrong on the projected population size 25, 50, 100 years from now. It's certainly possible that fertility is only temporarily low. Of course, at the moment we have the economic crisis, that does depress fertility a little bit, but it could be low for longer standing economic problems, youth unemployment that in some countries has persisted for decades. It might be low partly for somewhat technical reasons of how we measure it. the kind of measure I just gave you, that is about 1.5 or 1.6 births per woman in the rich industrial countries, that is based on the birth rates of women of all ages, say, in a current year, like 2010. It's called a period total fertility rate. It is subject to distortion. It can be misleading. When women are postponing the start of marriage and family building, postponing the first birth over time. So, for example, if women on average were having their first birth at age 25 in 2000, and by 2010, perhaps they were having their first birth by age 26 and a half. That's what I mean by postponement. Under those circumstances, this measure of fertility that I just described will understate the eventual number of children that women will have. And this kind of postponement of childbearing has been occurring, well, virtually around the world, but particularly in Europe, Japan, to some degree the United States. I'm not sure about Canada, but I imagine it has. And so these measures of low fertility, below replacement, for the rich industrial countries are very likely somewhat overstated. And if we were to make a correction for that, that might add another 0.2 or 0.3 children. So they'd still be below replacement, but not as far below. So we don't know. We're not sure. Are we mismeasuring current fertility, perhaps? Are we misunderstanding why fertility is low? Perhaps it's for transitory reasons that are going to go away, or perhaps fertility will rise again in the future. We don't know really to what level. It's easy to think, 2 or 2.1 births per woman is sort of the long-run natural equilibrium level, and that's where we're going to head in the long run. Don't really know whether that's true.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Ronald Lee, professor of demography and director of the Center for the Economics and Demography of Aging at the University of California at Berkeley. So you mentioned that this could be potentially inaccurate or misleading. So could you actually explain what you think of the UN projections then?
Well, the UN, like anyone else doing a projection, has to make some assumption about where fertility is going. And for the rich industrial countries, they assume that fertility is gradually going to be rising back towards replacement level, slowly but surely. So they are placing their bet on the assumption that fertility is not going to stay as low as it has been. But if the reason fertility is low now is more deeply structural and has to do with changing women's roles, the fact that women are so much more in the labor force now, that makes bearing children very expensive because bearing children requires that one or the other parent spends more time at home and less time in the market, or else that people rely more on organized child care, but then they're missing out on some of the experience of raising their children, and so on and so forth. There may be reasons like this why fertility is so low, and those reasons may just be a permanent part of life going forward. So we don't really know, and we have to acknowledge that we just don't know when there's a good deal of uncertainty in our projections of fertility. Here I've just focused on the industrial countries, but take China, the largest country in the world. First of all, we don't know what the current level of fertility is. The officially reported statistics may be biased upwards, is one concern. They may be biased upwards because there are some agencies in China, and particularly the Family Planning Agency, that has some incentive to make fertility seem a little higher than it is. We don't know that it's being misstated, but most experts now seem to think that fertility in China is around 1.5 or perhaps 1.6 births per woman. We're not sure. We don't have good, clean measures. Secondly, then, for the same reasons that we don't know where fertility is going in Europe or Japan, we don't know where it's going in China. Yes, they have a one-child policy. They've had a one-child policy for many years, but we don't know that that is what has brought fertility so low in China and kept it so low for this period. Fertility is also low in other countries in East Asia, Taiwan, South Korea. It's comparably low. If you look at the history of fertility in those countries, it doesn't look so different than the history of fertility in China, and yet they didn't have something like the one-child policy. So we don't know just why fertility is low in these East Asian countries now, currently, and we don't know really what's going to happen in the future.
Well, you wrote an article for Science, and this is why I found this so fascinating, because a lot of countries are basing a lot of their policy decisions on these kind of forecasts.
Yeah. I've been talking a lot about how much we don't know and how uncertain all this is. But I also have to say, I've been using United Nations projections for many years, and I've done my own studies of how accurate they have been in the past. And I've also taken part in organized studies by other groups, for example, a panel of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences looking at the accuracy of population forecasts. So I've seen a lot of analyses of how accurate the United Nations projections are. And I think they are really remarkably accurate. Yes, they make a lot of errors for individual countries. That's inevitable. But if you look at averages for larger regional aggregates or for the globe, many of these errors cancel out. Okay, so that's on the side of saying, given how many sources of uncertainty we have, the United Nations and other forecasting groups really have done a remarkably good job. But to get more directly to your point, yes, there is uncertainty about these projections for the future, and at the same time, we have to make important and costly and painful decisions based on these projections, even given their uncertainty. That's what we're seeing in the rich industrial countries today, faced with, of course, the immediate debt crisis, but also the long-term projected deficits that exist in virtually all rich industrial countries that have to do with the projections of population aging, which will make public pension programs and the public provision of health care and the public provision of long-term care, all of these publicly provided goods and services for the elderly, much more expensive, maybe twice or three times as expensive relative to the labor income or the working age population as they are today. So we have to make decisions about how to structure our programs, whether we should raise taxes, whether we should cut benefits, whether we should raise the retirement age, whether we should change the cost of living adjustment. All of these kinds of things have to be decided today based on imperfect information about what the future will bring.
Thanks very much for being here, Ron.
It was a pleasure to talk with you, Desiree, and thanks for having me.
You can find a link to Ron's article on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back to talk about the possible consequences of population growth with Bill Ryerson, president of the Population Media Center, after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com. Or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
My guest tonight is Bill Ryerson. Bill is the president of the Population Institute and founder of Population Media Center. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Desiree, thanks for having me on.
Now, I want you to tell us about what Population Media Center does, but first, let's talk numbers. So right now, mid-August of 2011, what's the approximate human population of Earth?
We're closing in on 7 billion.
Now, most of that 7 billion number represents a dramatic increase in human population in the 20th century, correct?
Yeah, it took all of human history to get us to 1 billion in about 1800. And then we reached the second billion in 1930, 130 years later. The Industrial Revolution, aided by the discovery of oil, led to great expansion of lifespans and reduction of infant mortality. And then around the time of World War II, infant mortality really came down around the world because of public health measures, including vaccination programs, and population started growing in the second half of the last century by about a billion a decade. So, and we're still in that phase now. We're growing at about a billion every 12 years.
But the rate of population increases has actually gone down quite recently, hasn't it?
The rate has gone down, but the rate is being applied against an ever-growing base. So, in fact, the increment in terms of numbers has not been going down recently. We're still growing by about 83 million a year.
Okay, so now that we know where we stand, let's talk about what we're looking at in the future. Now, your staff sent us a United Nations population projection that runs through the year 2100. And the numbers are really interesting. First of all, there are four different projections, and they do vary pretty dramatically.
The median projection is what many journalists assume is just a given. But in fact, it's based on assumptions that are open to scrutiny. And I think in particular the median projections, because by calling them the median projections, the UN Population Division implies they're the most likely to occur.
Right.
One of the assumptions to get us to about 9.3 billion by 2050 and 10.1 billion by 2100 is that fertility rates approaching 2050 will have fallen to 1.85 children per woman globally. In countries like Nigeria, where the average desired number of children is 7 among women and 9 among men, to just assume that fertility rates will fall to 1.85 children is not based on anything other than plugging a number into the computer.
Well, the high variant, it looks like we increased to 15.8 billion. That is frightening.
It is frightening when you think about where we are in the history of the use of oil. Since our whole industrial civilization and agricultural system globally depends on cheap oil and has now for much of the last century.
Exactly.
We're facing a very difficult situation far before we get to 9.3, 10.1, or 15 billion, because oil has been essentially stagnant in both discovery and production, that is, extracting it out of the ground, for the last 5 years. And many experts, including the U.S. military, which has posted this on one of their websites, anticipate that oil will go into inexorable long-term decline in availability starting in this decade.
Well, on the possibly optimistic side, the low variant is actually a decrease to 6.1 billion.
That's based on much lower fertility rates assumed, again, in every country of the world, with no assumption that below replacement level fertility in some European countries would come up to a norm of 1.85.
It seems like fertility really is the key variable in these projections, isn't it?
It is. There are assumptions about the mortality rates as well, that life expectancy will continue a gradual increase around the world. Now, certainly, if we just look in the rearview mirror, that is a justified position because that's been happening over the last several decades. And I think most people agree that longer lifespans are a nice thing. However, given what I just said about the oil situation, and given that world agriculture depends on oil in all phases, planting, plowing, harvesting, fertilizing, transport to market, pumping of irrigation water, refrigeration, and cooking, the possibility of lifespan staying long and mortality rates continuing to decline, I think, is in grave doubt.
Well, fertility is definitely influenced by economic factors.
Yes. Although the exact cause and effect relationship between the two is a little bit open to question. I wrote a lengthy paper called 16 Myths About Population Growth, and I dealt with this issue because there has been a strain of government attitude saying all we need to do is increase economic welfare and family planning doesn't need to be supported, it'll take care of itself. Hmm. What I said in my paper is if economic development is a contraceptive, it has a high failure rate because there are many examples of countries where economic development has occurred and fertility rates have gone up, and where economic depressions have occurred, like in the United States and currently in Russia, and fertility rates have gone down. So it's not absolutely clear what is causing the correlation between economic welfare and low fertility rates. What is clear is that lower fertility rates almost always lead to economic improvement. Very interesting study that was the work of a Princeton demographer named Ainsley Cole. He looked at countries that had started at a given year with the same fertility rate and the same income. And over he showed that when countries worked to bring the fertility rate down, there was a short lag and then their economies took off. What caused this was that without any change in family income, couples with fewer children could save some of the money they were otherwise spending on survival needs of food, housing, and clothing and put it in the bank. That led to capital formation. That right. led to businesses being able to borrow and expand, leading to employment growth in the face of declining numbers of people entering the labor force. That led to increased incomes. And also the savings could be used for education, which led to increased economic productivity at the family and national level, and through government taxation could be put into infrastructure, which also improved economic productivity. So all of those factors showed that reducing fertility rate has what is now called a demographic dividend with regard to economic growth.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're talking with Bill Ryerson, president of the Population Institute and founder of Population Media Center, about global population growth, what it means for our planet, and what we might be able to do about it. So it probably goes without saying that the increasing population of Homo sapiens has had a significant impact not only on our living conditions, but on the planet. And you are expecting those impacts to become a lot more unpleasant as we grow.
I am. As the U.S. President's Commission on Population Growth and the American Future said in its report in 1972, with few exceptions of those who may be speculating in land or looking for cheap labor, there is no benefit to increasing population. And there are many problems that are made much more difficult to solve by increasing population.
Well, the Population Media Center website lists four major topics where you see population growth as being dangerous: international security, the environment, poverty, and food and water scarcity. So maybe we can go through some of those and talk about what effect you see population growth having on those areas. Let's start with the big one. How do you see the increasing numbers of humans affecting the overall environment on Earth?
The most important, I think, is the issue of biodiversity. Now, many people wake up or might wake up in the morning and say, what's biodiversity ever done for me and who cares? But what is critically important are the large populations of plants and some animals like honeybees that make the planet habitable. As David Suzuki often says, if you were to have visited the planet 3 billion years ago, you would not have survived more than a couple of minutes because there was no oxygen in the atmosphere. The water was filled with toxic minerals, so you had nothing to drink, and there was no food. And it's taken 3 billion years of evolution of a very complex web of life that makes the planet inhabitable. And we are systematically destroying that web of life by killing off large populations of plants and animals that support the habitability of the planet. There's a very important study by two biologists that's just come out on how the whole approach of setting aside protected areas like national parks has done nothing to stop the decline of biodiversity as human populations have grown, because most of the true biodiversity services of plants and animals are in areas that are not protected. And as human numbers expand, humans encroach more and more on wilderness areas. They cut down forests for lumber, for both firewood and for housing, and they destroy systematically the biodiversity that is the lungs of the planet in places like the Amazon and the web of life that makes the planet habitable.
And there are other environmental issues as well.
Oh, of course. For example, climate change. Now, we're already beginning to witness changes in the average temperature of the planet. So this decade has been the hottest on history. The second hottest was the last decade. And the population aspect of that is not negligible. Many people say, well, it's not the poor people's fault that we have climate change. We need to reduce the consumption of the rich, which is definitely true. But we also have aspirations of people all over the world to be rich. And the position that people take of it's not the population really implies that the poor are virtuous as long as they remain poor.
Right.
What is clear is that even in countries where low per capita emissions exist, where most of the population growth that is occurring is taking place, it will over the next half century, that number of people is contributing significantly to climate change. For example, China has surpassed the United States in total carbon dioxide emissions. And if you look at the median projection, adding about 2.4 billion people to the population over the next 50 years, that is the climate equivalent of adding two United States to the planet. So this is not insignificant, even if it is occurring in low-emission countries. And, of course, the growth of places like the United States, which has the third largest increment in its population every year, growing by 3 million a year, is of particular concern from a climate standpoint, because each of those additional people is consuming and emitting at U.S. rates.
We have a couple of questions. Here's one via email from Jillian.
Population programs in China have resulted in a huge gender imbalance as families are all trying to have boys. How does this imbalance in the number of women to men affect birth rates?
The policy may be contributing to the imbalance in the gender ratio, but not necessarily. There's been longstanding preference for sons for cultural reasons, in that the son is seen as the person who will support the parents, whereas the daughter goes off and supports somebody else's family. And you see in a country that doesn't have that kind of policy, India, the same kind of imbalance. So it's not clear to what extent the one-child policy in urban areas has contributed to China's lopsided sex ratio. Certainly, having more men in the population than women over time will cause a lot of problems, one of which is there are millions of men who will not find marriage partners, and that may lead to all kinds of social issues. But it's not clear to what extent it's going to affect the birth rate going forward.
And we have a question via email from Wendy.
Would your group ever advocate enforced family planning, such as limiting the amount of children a family can have?
I think coercion is a bad idea, even if it weren't a human rights violation. That is to say, clearly,
The violation of human rights is of very great concern in places where coercion occurs. And let's not forget that coercive pregnancy has occurred in multiple places, including church-imposed bans on contraception in much of Latin America for much of the middle of the last century, in the Philippines today, in Ceausescu's Romania, and so on. But coercion often backfires, as we have seen. It certainly backfired when Indira Gandhi tried it in the 1970s. I happened to have been in India at the time. And her idea of allowing her son to carry out involuntary sterilization campaigns caused her government to fall and led to a setback to the family planning program in India, from which they have never fully recovered. So clearly, countries like Thailand and Sri Lanka and other Asian tigers that have gotten to replacement-level fertility, for the most part, have done it voluntarily. And voluntarism has the great benefit that the people are buying into it and doing it because they want to, not because they're being forced to. So I really think coercion is a very bad strategic idea, let alone the violation of human rights that it involves.
And some more environmental questions from an email from Atlas.
Is there any truth to the idea that increasing affluence leads to dietary changes which increase carbon emissions?
Yes, absolutely. For example, in China, as their economy has grown, people are moving up the food chain from eating rice to eating beef, chicken, and pork. Now, it takes about 10 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of beef. And so when you think about grain equivalent and the water that's involved and the emissions of carbon dioxide that's involved in production of livestock and the grain to feed them, there is a much greater impact on the environment and on the climate by having people eating meat than eating vegetarian diets. So indeed, that is important. It's also causing greater demand for grain, since if people eat 1 pound of beef, they're eating the equivalent of 10 pounds of grain. And so in a world that is growing short of access to grain, the very poor on the planet are faced with terrible food insecurity, particularly as the price of grain is going up. And so in terms of allowing other people to eat, it is a very good idea, let alone better for your health, to eat very little meat.
Now, I do actually want to talk about food and water scarcity, but one last question from the chat from Nicole.
I've heard it said that the Earth is going through its sixth major extinction event. Is that true, and how would we know? Are humans to blame?
The answer is yes and yes. There have been several major periods of extinction. Of course, the one that's most commonly known to people is the extinction of the dinosaurs that occurred over a period of millions of years. But there were many other species that went extinct at about the same time. So that was one of the major events. The one we're in now is primarily human-driven, and it is at a higher rate of extinction per year, per century, than previous periods of extinction have experienced. And it is primarily driven by human encroachment on wilderness areas around the planet, limiting habitat for other species.
Now let's talk about food and water scarcity, because quite honestly, this is the one that frightens me most. So how do you see those increasing numbers affecting that?
Let's talk about just a couple of countries, and then we'll expand it across the planet. The top three grain producers on the planet are India, China, and the United States. India is using underground aquifers to irrigate its crops, as well as using the rivers that flow seasonally with ice melt from the Himalayas. China the same. And in fact, they are both overpumping their underground aquifers, as is the southwestern United States. By overpumping, I mean they're taking more water out of those aquifers than is being replaced by rainwater. Mm-hmm. And so the water tables are sinking. Parts of India now are losing or having water tables sinking by 10 feet a year. So the farmers are having to drill deeper and deeper every year to get water. Clearly, this is unsustainable. There are places where farmers can no longer reach any water. Their land has turned to desert and they've given up. And so as India and China start using up the water they have, and indeed they're already using the rivers heavily for irrigation. The Yellow River in China doesn't reach the ocean two-thirds of the year because it's all being used for irrigation. So that, combined with the likely melting of the glaciers of the Himalayas because of climate change, will lead to growing shortages of fresh water. India alone has over 100 million people who are surviving just because of overpumping. And if they were to only pump at a sustainable level, those 100 million people would starve. But, of course, the population of India is growing by a new Bombay every year. It's about a 17 million annual growth. China's growing by about 6 million a year. The U.S. is growing by 3 million a year. If you were to read the papers in California, you'd see there are battles over water every day between agriculture, industry, and municipalities. And there's not enough water in dry parts of this continent, as well as in China and India, to meet all the needs. And indeed, on a global basis, we're seeing the same thing. Water is being way overused, and that, combined with climate change, is threatening food security. Now, as I mentioned, oil is another major factor in agriculture. In fact, oil really is the driver of the agricultural system, as I explained earlier, with it being used in every aspect of agriculture. And we've been smart enough as humans to get the cheap and easy oil first. You know, Pennsylvania in the 1800s, you could poke a stick in the ground and find oil. Now, we're having to drill through thousands of feet in risky conditions in the Arctic and in the Gulf of Mexico to find oil. And every country, with a very few exceptions, that has oil is in decline in production. The United States went into decline in the 1970s, and it's never recovered despite all of the efforts at drilling new wells. What is clear is that this is a non-replaceable resource in terms of the lifetime of humans. This is developed and accumulated over a period of millennia, and it's being used up in a period of a little more than a century and a half. What we're faced with is what is likely to be a collapse in availability of oil. We saw in 2008, when Saudi Arabia had a 7% decline in oil production, a huge spike in the price of oil. The market was responding to the fear that Saudi Arabia had finally gone into decline, and oil went up to $140 a barrel. And there were food riots all over the world because food is directly tied to the price of oil. Now we're in a situation where oil is varying, but in the neighborhood of $100 a barrel. It's a little less in the last couple of weeks, but it's still considerably higher than it has been historically. And the price of food is reflecting that and is also reflecting the growing shortage of water. So there are 1.2 billion people on the planet who live on a dollar or less a day. Those people spend almost all of their income on getting enough food to survive.
Right.
One can calculate what has to happen to the price of oil to drive the price of food, even if it's available in the market, to a level that those billion people will starve to death. And if it happens, which it likely will because we've done so little about creating the technology, or the infrastructure rather, for alternative renewable energy sources, we can envision the time when all 1.2 billion people living on less than a dollar a day start to starve all at once. And it won't be like a regional drought in Somalia and Kenya. It will be all over the planet, but heavily concentrated in Africa and Asia. And that's what the military is concerned about from a security standpoint. It's also, of course, a human rights, human welfare concern. But the concern is that people will be rampaging across the planet looking for food. And indeed, India is anticipating this and is building a fence along the border with Bangladesh because they fear that Bangladesh will be in this situation and people will be rampaging into India.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're talking with Bill Ryerson, founder of Population Media Center, about global population growth and the things that might be in store for us if we don't slow it down. And we'll be right back after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we'll talk to entomology blogger Bug Girl. She's covered all kinds of things that creep, crawl, and fly. She'll tell us about her favorite insects and why she finds them all so fascinating. And anthropologist and blogger Greg Layden joins us to discuss the cultural taboos surrounding eating insects. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. My guest today is Bill Ryerson, president of the Population Institute and founder of Population Media Center. We're discussing the problems caused by the growing number of people inhabiting planet Earth and what groups like Bill's are doing to try to help. So before the break, we were talking about your predictions for some of the effects of population growth on the planet. So what I'd like to do is go back and play devil's advocate, because you're painting a pretty scary picture of the effects, and I'm wondering if the outlook is really that dire. For instance, on the topic of food resources, there have been predictions of food shortages and population crashes before.
The one that's most commonly cited is Paul Ehrlich. Ehrlich, when he wrote his book, The Population Bomb, in 1968, did not know about the work of Norman Borlaug, who in 1972 received the Nobel Peace Prize for being the father of the Green Revolution. And rapidly during the decade of the 70s, high-yield wheat, high-yield rice, and high-yield corn were adopted by farmers throughout much of Asia, leading what was imminent starvation in India to India becoming an exporting country of grain. So, indeed, I think Ehrlich's to be forgiven for essentially being ahead of his time and not understanding what all might be coming down the pike. But nevertheless, there have been doomsayers for a long time. That doesn't mean necessarily that the basic concept of carrying capacity is wrong. It just means that forecasts with regard to time may have been wrong. Now, I clearly have painted a grim picture. And I am increasingly pessimistic as I watch what's happening on the planet and the failure of governments to even agree that there is something called climate change or to do anything about it or to invest while we still have oil in the creation of steel for a whole alternative energy infrastructure at the level we need for our civilization. On the other hand, the good news is I think we know how to solve the problem. And if we can get people involved and speaking to their elected representatives in a way that is forceful, we might be able to mobilize the courage to do what needs to be done after trying everything else first. And clearly there may be innovations that will come along that will buy us some more time. What Borlaug said, and I've heard him say it in person, was that the Green Revolution bought us 30 years of time in which to get our act together to solve the population problem, or it would be worse after it was all over. Well, the 30 years have run out, and there is no clear evidence of any new Green Revolution that will lead to the same percentage increase in yield per acre that we saw during the 70s. So,
what about genetically modified foods?
There are various genetically modified foods that have increased productivity per acre, and that may continue. But what food experts like Lester Brown, who was Undersecretary of Agriculture before founding World Watch Institute and then Earth Policy Institute, which he now runs, says is that there's no evidence that genetically modified foods are going to lead to a whole-scale increase in food productivity.
You know, talking about those innovations, in the past we always have been able to innovate and invent our way out of these kind of situations, ones that threaten us as a species. So why do you think that we won't be able to do that this time?
I'm not saying we won't. What I'm saying is this. For many decades now, the world scientists have been saying to the world leaders, the population issue should not be neglected. It is driving us towards a precipice. Mm-hmm. Now, we may be, through innovation, able to push that precipice further and further ahead of us, but we are still speeding toward it. And at the UN Population Conference in Cairo in 1994, which I attended, the world's governments pledged to dramatically increase support for family planning. What has happened since that time is they have cut funding for family planning in half. So if we only did what needs to be done to stop this train of rapid population growth, we might be able to have a soft landing. But we have now well-funded campaigns out there urging people to have larger families and urging governments to promote population growth. And it is done primarily for economic interests. For example, in Germany, I spoke at the Global Economic Symposium that was held in Germany a couple of years ago, and Germany is paying $13,000 per German baby born. This, in a time of climate change, water shortages, energy shortages, makes no sense. But it also is worsening Germany's old age dependency because actually the aged in Germany, to a large extent, have savings. But infants are 100% dependent on the working adults that have them. So by encouraging people to have babies at a time when the baby boom itself is aging and going to need support is actually worsening the dependency ratio situation. And they could much more easily solve their pension problem by adjusting pension rates, changing retirement ages that were set during the time of Bismarck, and encouraging people to continue working longer years as they're now able to, given the greater health and longevity of people of Germany. But Germany is an example of what's going on in many countries that think the idea of stopping population growth is a terrible idea.
Right.
At the same time, in very poor countries whose poverty is being in part driven by large family size, funding for family planning information and services, as I've mentioned, has been reduced. But there is one thing that many people, even in the field, don't know, which is lack of access to contraception is not the proximate barrier to family planning use. When you look at the demographic and health survey data, it is clear that the primary reasons for non-use are misinformation and cultural issues.
Right.
So, for example, there are whole campaigns to convince people that condoms contain the AIDS virus and the lubricant, or that the pills cause cancer, both of which are blatantly false. But people are falling victim to that misinformation.
We have a question from the chat. This is from Gold.
Do you see things ever getting so bad we end up with a Soylent Green scenario? And if so, what practical solutions would need to be implemented to avoid it?
I'm going to try to respond to that with a note of optimism, because I don't want people getting too pessimistic. Population Media Center has discovered that it is quite possible to use totally voluntary informational programs that dramatically change fertility rates and by changing desired number of children. And we believe it is possible to avoid these kinds of scenarios through programming that reaches large numbers of people with information in a way that is accessible. What we do in various developing countries is what I call family planning soap operas. These are primetime, long-running, serialized dramas, in many countries on radio because they're still radio societies, where characters gradually evolve into role models for the audience for daughter education, elevation of women's status, spousal communication about family planning, use of family planning, child spacing for better health, limiting the number of children for better economic welfare, showing through the characters the consequences of behavior change, and showing the audience through these transitional characters how to overcome the obstacles to change in that society. These are all based on policies of each country. They're all locally written in local languages by teams that we train. In Nigeria, we did a program of this type on radio in Hausa, in the Hausa-speaking northern part of the country, which is a conservative Muslim area. And the post-broadcast survey showed
that 72% of the population had listened to the program at least weekly. It was a twice-a-week program. At the family planning clinics, healthcare workers asked clients what had caused them to come in, and 67% of them named the program by name.
This is fascinating, this type of educational outreach. One of the areas you do conduct a lot of research in is the effectiveness of this type of narrative programming. So
yes.
How does it compare to more traditional education outreach?
Well, when one thinks about education, particularly if they're out of academia, they think you provide information. And when I first got into the population field, I thought, well, we just need to tell people what's what. But in fact, most of us don't make decisions about childbearing on the basis of global demographic trends. And instead, we are driven by things very personal to us. And we also know, living in North America, that people are very much influenced by entertainment programs. Characters can have a huge effect on styles of all kinds and on fads, on names people give to their children, and so on. And so using entertainment, which is what people want in the evening after a hard day of work, to show consequences, positive or negative, of various behaviors of characters without ever telling the audience what to do, can draw in a huge audience and dramatically influence norms in the society, whereas just giving people information is boring and they turn it off and it has no impact. In fact, emotional involvement is critically important for remembering the lessons that one learns. So if you think about, if you were Age of Reason on September 11th, 2001, you know, how clearly do you remember that day when you heard the news? And how clearly, in comparison, do you remember September 10th, 2001? It's very clear that emotional involvement enhances memory. So we're teaching our kids in school with blah, blah, blah that they remember just long enough to pass the final exam, when emotional involvement of students is critical to get them to learn lessons.
I find this brilliant.
And well, people can find out much more about it at populationmedia.org. And by the way, for your listeners, people can subscribe to a daily article on global sustainability issues I send to a mailing list.
Perfect. I think we have time for one last question, and it's from the chat, and it's from Loxloy.
I remember that the population question was considered an environmental issue in the 60s and 70s. Now it seems to be ignored by the environmental movement. What happened?
They got scared, but now some of the environmental groups are saying, yep, it really is an environmental issue. So there are some nervy front runners. The Center for Biological Diversity, for example, has a whole section of population on their website, and they look at the link between population growth and threats to biodiversity. So they're an environmental group that has decided to buck the trend. A number of other environmental groups have started population programs. They're still way too quiet about it. They need to hear from the total 10 million members of the environmental organizations that population, of course, is a critical issue. They cannot achieve their respective missions if human population numbers continue to grow. And speaking out on the population component of environmental issues is something that would be a huge contribution to sustainability of the planet.
Thanks for being here, Bill.
Thank you. It was great fun.
And you can find out more about Bill Ryerson and the work of the Population Media Center through the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. From there, keep clicking your way to Facebook, to Twitter, or to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Ray Shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells, cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks, all the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, who, I don't think you understand, it's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless, let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore, just a microscope,
telescope magnifier. Reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.